Paul told me this was supposed to be like a 20-minute plus 40-minute discussion sort of talk, so I'm not sure I've achieved that aim, but I'm happy if we don't get past the first couple slides.
We have to be out of here by 3, otherwise the people will take us personally and throw us
out. Yeah, they have a lot of pull. Okay, so, but I guess I'll...
It is 3 today, Matt, right? Yeah,
yeah.
Somebody else occupies this room at 3, yes.
So all my punchlines are going to be on basically the first real slide, and so if we don't get past that slide, it's fine. So also, I've had a couple people come up to me, and they want to know, you know, so you many-body guys, why do you exist? You know, what's your reason for getting up in the morning? And so if this also devolves into some kind of discussion about that, I think that could also be entirely, I'd be happy with that if people in the audience are interested in that. So today I'm going to talk about an effort as a many-body person to meet experiments at the temperatures that they're at and the densities that they're at, especially in the experiments at Gila, where I'm at. And to see some interesting things from either a condensed matter perspective or a metrology quantum information perspective. So here are the collaborators that I've done a lot of this work with. Anna Maria Ray, my advisor, she's been really key in everything. And Michael Fosfeig is an exceptional graduate student who just graduated and is now a postdoc at JQI. And so I would say a lot of the best ideas in this talk are actually here, his, and you should get to know Michael. Salvatore Monmana did a lot of this work. Alexei is the one who really got me thinking about quantum magnetism and cold molecules in the first place. And then these are the experimentalists that we've meet with every week and discuss these ideas. And then these three guys, John Bollinger's group, they work at NIST doing ion experiments. And so at the end, I'll show some connections between the things I'm talking about in molecules and the experiments they're doing in ions. So to start with, here are all the punchlines on my first slide, like I promised. Ultracold molecules in lattice open up all kinds of rich Hamiltonians to engineer and allow for interesting phases of matter if you can reach the ground state. Now, with these new ideas of using dynamics that I'm going to talk about today, you can actually do things even without being in the ground state, even at these hot temperatures. That's it. That's really my punchline, and if that's all you take home, is that I'll be very happy. So by current conditions, this means sparse lattices of 1 in 10 sites and temperatures of 100 nanokelvin, few hundred nanokelvin. If I slip into calling a microkelvin gas of molecules warm, just understand that's my perspective on these things. But hopefully some of these ideas can apply to microkelvin or even warmer gas of molecules. And the other thing which I'd really like to get across here is that many-body physics in the context of cold atoms, it's very conventionally thought of as, okay, this is emulating condensed matter. This is doing things condensed matter people want to do. And that's very important, but there's more to many-body physics than condensed matter. Of course, there's nuclear physics and low-temperature physics and this kind of thing, but it actually ties quite strongly into precision metrology and sensing, and I'll get into that as the talk goes on. So here's the dream, and this is really a dream that dates back to Feynman back in, I think, 82, when he was saying, what if we could solve otherwise intractable problems? So solve, say, the eigenstates of a Hamiltonian or the dynamics of a Hamiltonian, such as that describing Herbert Smithite, which condensed matter people love for reasons I won't go into, but it's that rock. And what if you could solve this by mimicking it with another quantum system? And in this case, it might be an ultra-cold gas of KRB. And so this is kind of where we want to go. And if everything worked out ideally, you'd type in, okay, plutonium, uranium-5, what's the phase diagram? And your machine here would spit it out. Of course, we're nowhere near that dream. So why do we dream? I think this was some science fiction story, but there's one reason, which is pure intellectual fascination. So what happens in a lot of these exotic models that people could cook up in condensed matter is that the excitations look nothing like the excitations of the system at a single particle level. So let me give a concrete example. If I had a bunch of spin ones around, so spin one objects have 3 states, and I excite them, I might expect to see some spin one excitations. what can happen in phases of matter is you have a system entirely consisting of spin ones, and then you poke on it, and it looks like there are a bunch of spin one halves floating around. Or likewise, you have a system entirely of bosons sitting on a lattice, and when you shake it, its behavior is described exactly like non-interacting fermions. This is a very, very bizarre thing to see, and this is what is called fractionalization. And this goes along with other buzzwords like topological ordering. So, you know, there could be many, many talks about this box, but I want to give some idea that I think this is a pretty fascinating thing at a purely intellectual level. Yeah?
Yeah, for this example you just gave, do you have any experimental evidence outside AMO?
So there's none in AMO, but outside of AMO, there's one example I know of where it's very clear that there is something like this going on, and that's the fractional quantum Hall effect. And in the fractional quantum Hall effect, you have electrons, of course, which have charge E, and depending on your magnetic field, you see a conductance which is consistent with the charges having the effective charge carriers having charge E over 3, or E over 5.
That's a tricky question. So what is the advantage of seeing that again in AMO?
So the advantage of seeing an AMO is that so there are, in some sense, infinitely many of these phases predicted. There are many families of these phases. Unlike traditional phases of matter, solid, liquid, symmetry-breaking phases, there is no classification of what even phases are possible in this case. I've lost someone already. So seeing it in AMO really allows you to have a much broader range of examples.
They've manipulated matter, perhaps?
Absolutely. And you have unique tools to probe these things that just don't exist in the solid state. So, for example, in solid state, even in the fractional quantum Hall, it's never really been conclusively shown that these charges have fractional statistics, so they're supposed to be in between fermions and bosons, and you get some other phase other than 1 or minus 1 when you exchange them. And so it's really hard to see this directly. You can at least, if you're getting fancy in AMO, really imagine creating two of these in some single site resolution experiment and braiding them around each other and maybe getting access to it. But I think the big reason is there's a lot of flexibility. And there are many candidates in condensed matter, actually a handful of candidates for other types of exotic states, topological type states. But they're so messy that nobody can really agree whether they're exotic or dirt or anything. So that should give you an idea. But it's not just intellectual fascination. These states, if you start thinking long-term, actually could have applications. So the one probably everyone's heard about at least once is that if you had a topologically ordered state or a sufficiently exotic topologically ordered state, you could do universal quantum computation that is robust to noise, robust to perturbations, robust to decoherence. And so the way you do this is you make these little excitations and you braid them around each other and all this. That's a very advanced application. Even, again, verifying that two of these qubits behave as expected is a long-term proposition, I think. But there are,
yeah. Sorry, I don't know, I've always liked saying this, and I kind of like saying this, but it's hard to imagine that the way at least we create these kind of topological systems in AMO, that they'll be protected in the same way, you know, fractional quantum Hall effect is, protected in condensed matter. So do you really believe this right one, that we're going to create with polar molecules or whatever other system, a topological system that can be really practically used for robust quantum computation?
Well, I don't believe it in solid state, so no, I don't believe it in AMO. I don't think it's in this.
In most cases, yeah. Among other things, but I mean, especially whether it's robust, very much the question of how two-dimensional you can get that. So how much you can actually suppress the third dimension. I think if you can do that in a solid state perfectly, I think you are pretty robust, but I think it's similarly true.
This is definitely the case, but what I meant is that for us, in order to create this particular, you know, topological system, we need to do some engineering. And this engineering is the stuff that's not robust. While in condensed matter case, usually just comes sort of as a strong interacting gas with these.
So this is a good question, which certainly I haven't even thought about, and it would be interesting to know. But there is a lot of engineering that goes into this, and we know these phases are robust. Are they in fact robust to the kinds of perturbations on the sorts of engineering you have to do? And as long as it only perturbs locally, at least at the level of like sort of formal mathematical theorems, it has to be protected against that. But you know, but I think these are interesting questions to understand better. But anyway, I'm not trying to sell you that we're going to build a quantum computer, but I'm saying maybe 500 years down the line, when people get around to doing this in solid state, maybe AMO platforms will also be competitive for this. Okay. I'm not submitting any quantum information grants, so I can talk like this. For other applications, and I think this is actually considerably more realistic, forget about full quantum computation. This robustness, without doing any fancy gates or anything, it means that maybe you can at least store some quantum information. So you can sit there, you can make a superposition, have it very long-lived, or you can even make some entangled state and store it there, and it will sit there and be robust to the noise. And that can be done, I think, much more easily. Still not easily, but much more easily. And that also applies to the sorts of what Alexei was talking about a couple weeks ago, symmetry-protected topological phases. Those are also robust to all local perturbations that obey some symmetry. So if you break that symmetry, you're out of luck, but if you have that symmetry for some reason, then you're protected. And, you know, many times the things in a lab do end up having some symmetry to them. In fact, every conventional phase of matter to exist requires a symmetry, so we're very comfortable with including symmetries as a requirement for something. So anyways, and then maybe the reason that the way that most condensed matter people think about it is every new phase of matter, regardless of whether it's exotic or not exotic, has a different response to probes. So if I put on an electric field, a current flows. How does that relationship go? That kind of thing in every phase is different. And so, you know, I like to talk about exotic phases allow you to break the shackles of conventional many-body theory. So in a Fermi liquid, there's always one relation between, say, the heat capacity and the conductance and these kinds of things. If I go to an exotic phase, can I get new relations? And who knows? You know, engineers don't even think about this because they deal with metals all day and this kind of thing. So maybe there are... this is kind of the biggest motivation in general. So I don't know. Those are just some, you know, I'm just throwing out some buzzwords and some things off the top of my head, but these are the things that really interest me about condensed matter physics. And somewhat intellectual, somewhat it's thinking very long term, what sorts of applications might this open up? But of course, I don't think we're going to go engineer anything in the lab today. Okay, so if there are no questions, maybe I'll continue on to more of the story I want to tell today. So, said the vision and why we dream. So here's a proposal, and this is just Alexei's talk in one slide. So Alexei's talk in one slide goes, we have potassium rubidium, and the way I've drawn it, I've approximated it as strontium oxide, which Stefan told us about. It's a nice rigid rotor, okay, strontium oxide is. So I'm drawing the rigid rotor spectrum here. And at least if we treat it properly, KRB looks sufficiently like this that we can get away with that. And so in an electric field, the rigid rotor levels split, and they split by an amount that's given by the electric field. And even for a pretty small electric field, these splittings get large compared to all the ultra-cold scales. So you're in the dipole interactions. So the temperature and the dipole interactions won't kick you out of whatever states you start in. If you start in some set of levels, then you'll never leave those levels on the time scales of the experiment, as long as that's split off. And Misha's shaking his head at this. So. Do you believe me?
No, I'm thinking about something.
You're shaking your head at something I said a while ago. Yeah, okay. So the simplest case that I want to talk about is just picking out two of these levels. And for ease of drawing, why not pick these two levels, the 0, 0, and 1, 0? This is a spin 1 half. So one molecule, I pick out these two levels by populating them initially. It gives me a spin 1 half. Okay, good. So we've understood one molecule. Now let's think about two molecules. In two molecules, these spin 1 halves have a different energy if they're down or down up, because the dipole moment for an up guy and a down guy is different. And so this gives me what looks like a SZ-SZ interaction, what's called an Ising interaction. And all that interaction says is there's a difference in energy between this and this. The other terms I have come from transition dipole matrix moments. So if I think really in terms of photons and everything, what's going on is if I initially have a state like this, this guy falls down, emits a photon, and this guy absorbs a photon. Of course, in the lab, this happens so fast, you can just think of it as
instantaneously swapping
like this. So there are these other terms, which I'll call flip-flop terms, and they allow you to do that.
So in this Hamiltonian, we don't have two-body correlations.
So this model, I mean, so what do you mean by, so this is a model, so the correlations are a product of the correlations have to do with the state. So do you mean in the ground state or in the dynamics or?
No, you have a term that describes interaction between two of these molecules.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so this is the interaction between molecule I. Sorry, I didn't say this. This is a good point. So the sum over ij here runs over molecules I and molecules j. And rij is the distance between them. You can put a 1 minus 3 cos squared there. Yeah. Okay.
Stupid question. So the only difference that we would have from that to a whatever two-level atom is that we wouldn't have the ZZ.
So depending on what two levels you're thinking about in the atom, you would have the ZZ term. I would say that, so I don't know what two levels, are you thinking about electronic levels or spinner?
In that case, we have only a flip-flop term.
Right, exactly, unless you polarize your atom somehow stronger.
Yeah, exactly. So you could do that with an atom, but you want the ZZ.
So you're really thinking about the photon exchange between excited electron, absolutely, then you just get these, and then, as you well know, there can be these, it may not just be a simple 1 over r cubed, there might be these 1 over r squared.
Sure.
And I would say the biggest difference from atoms is that there are no imaginary pieces here. These are all very stable, right? If I put it in an electron in a rotationally excited state, it will just live for minutes or who knows how long.
Do you have thermal fluctuations in other degrees freedom?
Yeah, this is an excellent question, and it in some ways will be a subject of the rest of the talk. So give me a couple slides, and if I haven't answered it by then ask me again. Okay.
One more question.
Yeah.
Just very trivial question. In your notation, you say XX set model, but the SI, SJ, that's XX plus YY.
Yeah, exactly. So J, this is the same thing as J perp times SX, SX plus SY, SY. And so, you know, maybe some other models that you've heard of, just to introduce some names. If I set J perp to 0, this is an Ising model. If I set J perp to JZ, this is the Heisenberg model, which is just the isotropic spin symmetric model. If I set JZ to 0, it's a spin 1/2 XX model.
Okay. You don't introduce like quantum fluctuations like SX term or something?
You mean like, oh, you mean a single particle term? I've chosen those. I swept that under the rug. They're there. That's something you can engineer on and off. So even strictly, you know, the difference between this energy and this energy, it's actually an Ising plus a single particle term, for example.
The difference of energy says is zero.
Yeah.
SX
yeah.
is just too small to bridge that gap, so that's drawn.
Yeah. Oh, you're asking about the SX term.
Exactly.
Those don't occur naturally, but you can turn them on if you wanted to.
They occur naturally. They're just dropped because they're too small compared to the energy gap.
No, they're definitely too small. I mean, if you introduce a microwave to...
Yeah, the naturally occurring ones are so far off resonance, they don't matter.
Exactly.
The ones, you can engineer one by applying a microwave on resonance with this, and that gives you a transverse field. So you can engineer, you can turn on a SX term if you want. Not for the things I'm going to show today. I have looked a little bit at this.
One more question. The matrix element that we argue that the double operator. Do you have cross terms between the two states that you consider? Or do you have also terms that correspond to the individual two states? In other words, the orientation cosines of the 0, 0 and the 1, 0 states. So you have just matrix element between 0, 0 and 1, 0. The cross terms, so to speak, are non-zero, then you have an equivalent with Ising, right?
If also the orientation cosines of the individual states are different from zero, then you get something for the village.
So maybe I will punt this to Alexei because I'm not sure I understand the language you're
trying. It's the same thing, the orientational cosine. So d times the orientational cosine is the precisely dz operator. Yeah. This dz operator is precise. So this jz is, for j perp say, is the expectation value, you know, up dz down, yeah, whole thing squared. So it's all there. Everything is there.
Yeah. I'm still trying to square this actually with the picture of the molecule in the electric field.
Yeah.
So this is why I'm having
a little bit.
Okay.
Right, but so the orientational cosine is the sort of d times the orientational cosine is the dz operator of the molecule, right?
Yeah. Yeah, so for these two states, we only have these dz terms, right?
Is considered to have simultaneously some structure while actually freely rotating. Then you have a little convergence. One can, of course, construct a model of that sort.
So what do you mean by freely rotating here? An electric field, it's not really freely rotating. It is oriented. I think I need to understand. I'm not sure I understand completely your question, but in electric field, these things get polarized. There's a diagonal matrix element of the dipole of the dz operator, and that is non-vanishing, and that gives you the jz terms. That's what gives you the energy difference between this and this. And then there's a transition matrix dipole between this and this, and that is what gives you these flip-flop terms. But I'm not sure that answers your
question. Maybe we'll answer your question. Actually, this assumes that the molecules are in a plane and the field is perpendicular to the plane.
I think.
I didn't forget. It's right there.
Well, it's written there, but you didn't say that. Maybe that helps or not.
It does.
Okay, yeah. So, and you can definitely do things where that's not the case, but that would put in some 1 minus 3 cos squared beta or more complicated things in here.
What kind of field do you actually need for that? I mean,
electric field?
What are you playing with? The difference between orientation of the lower and upper states, right?
But what you need to do to project out of this manifold is just to split these guys off.
It's based on the difference between interactions, right?
Different between induced dipoles.
Yeah, and yes.
So you mean what field do you need to get a sizable JZ?
Exactly, because the difference will be smaller than each of
them. So it turns out to get these things roughly comparable, you have to get, well, it depends what states you pick, but for these states I've drawn, you have to go up to a few kilovolts per centimeter, maybe even 6 kilovolts per centimeter for KRB. So this is large, but June and Debbie are building a cell that goes to 30, 40 kilovolts per
centimeter.
What's the, I don't know off the top of my head. Yeah. I know at the level of JZ, but I don't know what the dipole moment is.
Some fraction 0.5 or of yeah. Debye, which is roughly.
Well, for KRB, which is
true. I mean, it actually drops a bit from that because where these things are almost, if you say want to tune to the point where they're equal, where that happens is not actually, they're nowhere near the full permanent dipole, so you get another factor of 2 or 3 reduction from that.
Just make its elements in the dipole-dipole matrix.
I know, but probably you could have used, I mean, again, like microwaves that you will use anyway, like if you do microwave on the excited ones, you're still zero, so you can still have flip-flops and things.
So if you sorry, which states are you using this flip flop?
You use like 1-0 mixing with 2-0.
So then the flip flops get turned off at weak field at least, right? Because it's too much angular. So at weak field, you won't get any coupling between these guys, right? It's a vector operator, the dipole.
Okay.
Do you agree with this, Alexei?
I mean, I have no idea what you're asking. You were asking something, I think you were responding something
different. Yeah, probably. So one thing that I can say is that if you wanted to go to the point, if you want to shut J-perp off, you can do this by, for example, using this state and this state, because
I mean, like if you create a dress state 1-0 plus 2-0 with the microwave, use one of these dress states as your up state. I have a feeling that the difference between the zero dipole moment and this rotating frame dipole moment will be much more substantial than in an electric field. and flip-flops will be there. And I don't believe you never thought of that. That's why I'm asking.
No, I've never thought of that. No, I mean, it's possible.
There's a whole paper on precisely this configuration by Andrew Daly and Johannes
Schachenmeier.
What did you want to talk to Stick up?
I mean, this is really, there are many practical things you can do to boost this flexibility of how you can control these relative scales, but I'm really concentrating on the simplest thing here today. So there won't be any microwave dressing in what I show in this whole talk, for example. But yeah, I agree that when it, you know, if you really want to have the most control over Jz over Jperp, this by no means is probably what you want to do. Or maybe you want to use some dressing, or maybe you just want to pick other levels. So, just because I have to say it here, so this was a fascinating talk by Alexei, which showed if you do have some microwaves to dress, then you can just make an incredible range of models where now you put this 1 minus 3 cos squared theta in, but actually you put all the spherical harmonics in, and you can independently control the angular dependence of all five of these rank 2 spherical harmonics, and you can do it independently for Jz and Jperp. So this just opens up a zoo of spin models to play with. And some of them have been studied by condensed matter people, it turns out. And we know they harbor topological phases, so symmetry-protected topological phases, genuine topological phases, et cetera. And that's all explained in these papers. And it's, you know, I think this is the dream. So you do this, that's the dream. Okay. Favorite quote of mine. That's all I'm saying. No, okay, so I'm done. No, so what's the difference between the dream and what we have right now? So what do we need and what do we have? What we need is we need
a lattice.
Okay, great. So one group has a lattice at Jilla. They have Caribbean and optical lattice. This is very good. We need temperatures of 100 nanokelvin, and experiments, at least at Jilla, are down to about 300 nanokelvin. Okay, that's pretty reasonable. At least some people are getting there. We really need unit filling. So the models that condensed matter people talk about have one particle, one spin on a regular array of lattice sites. But if you look at the Jilla experiments, they don't really have a good handle on their densities, but they estimate it's about one particle every 10 sites. So they're pretty far from this limit. And of course they're pushing on this, and hopefully, you know, next year or sometime they'll come and give you a great talk about having one particle per site.
They can make 3D lattice. They can also make a pancake lattice.
Yeah.
And I believe that's a few hundred molecules.
Sure. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But you're thinking of the 3D.
Here I'm going to be thinking about a 3D lattice for reasons I'll explain in a second. Yes. So, but the main reason is to make this connection to condensed matter. But I think you can do beautiful experiments even in a 1D lattice. But when I mention 1/10 per site, I do mean in a 3D lattice with 532 nanometer lattice spacing. Okay, and now the thing that I actually think is the most difficult step in all this is, well, we say we had a Hamiltonian, but what's a Hamiltonian? I mean, we have to make a state, we have to make a ground state, we have to make a thermal equilibrium state or something. Well, so what we would like to do is find a way to let these rotational states of the spins build up some correlations, build up some entanglement, and really make some nice equilibrium or ground state. And I'm just making up a number and calling that a second. I have no idea how long it takes. I've never done a real calculation, but it's not going to be faster than 10 milliseconds, and I'd be shocked if it was that quick. So what do we have? We have the state down. Every molecule's in its rotational ground state. And so we have to ask, how can we get from here to let the system evolve into some equilibrium steady state for these proposals? And finally,
Well, no, I keep raising my hand. When you say 300 nanokelvin, what actually do you mean?
So that's in the absence of the lattice, actually. So this is roughly, I mean, so even talking about temperature in the lattice, it gets kind of weird. So basically these numbers refer to temperatures you might think are reasonable if you had the lattice off. Yeah, that's a very good question.
It's a non-equilibrium, non-thermal equilibrium lattice.
Right. So in the situation I'm going to be thinking about, it's going to be motionally out of equilibrium.
And what's the hopping time in these lattices?
It depends on the lattice depth, of course. In the case I'm going to be thinking about, it's going to be infinite, so there's going to be no tunneling. They can go to shallow lattices and have done this where it's very quick. The main advantage, give me a second and I'll get to this.
I think it's related. The Hamiltonian you wrote in the previous show us in the previous slide does not have kinetic energy, right?
It depends what you mean by kinetic energy, but if you mean molecules moving, that's exactly correct. So maybe I should say it here. So what I'm assuming here is that the molecules are frozen in place. And one way to do that is you put them in an optical lattice and you ramp up the lattice so deep the molecules don't move anymore.
Okay, so that temperature you showed the other slide?
Yeah, I don't know which temperature this one. Yeah, the 100, this one?
Yeah. Uh-huh. It's which temperature is that?
So this is the temperature before you ramp up the lattice. I may have got myself into trouble by even putting this temperature up here because you could have a big discussion about what this means. But basically, I mean, it's from thinking about if you want to be in the ground band of the lattice, how cold would you have to be? And, you know, 300 nanokelvin is maybe, depends on your lattice depth, but maybe a little warmer than you'd be comfortable with.
And you put it in the molecules and the temperature of the molecular sample before you transfer it to the optical lattice should determine as which levels.
Exactly, and so that in some ways these are even equivalent, which is why I put them together, right? So it's sort of your initial temperature is what determines your final density. I mean, also the initial density, but yeah. So I wouldn't think too hard about this temperature number. The real important thing to think about is this site filling.
Mm-hmm. Maybe to add, sort of, I'm sure you will say this later. That I mean, so you're asking, you were pointing this previous Hamiltonian. So, and the temperature here is the motional temperature, which a priori might not have much to do with the spin temperature, which is a model that came up with. I'm sure you'll say that.
Yeah, and so actually let me say that right now, because that's sort of what I was trying to say with this point. So the motional temperature sort of ceases to be relevant when I quench it into the lattice. It just looks like disorder because I don't know where my molecules are sitting anymore. But there is still this notion of spin temperature, and that's, you have this nice zero entropy state down, but it's a really excited energetic state. So you either need to dissipate that energy out while keeping your entropy low, or do some adiabatic transform into the ground state or something. So that's really this distinction between spin temperature. And so this temperature here has nothing to do with that spin temperature. But the important thing is the density, so getting to one molecule per site, and getting the spin temperature low, which is a separate problem.
Where they, but like if you have 1/10 filling, right, and disorder in the lattice, you always get something like spin glass because it's like interactions are random.
No.
Or you just say that you know all the positions and try to start from this point.
So I'm not going to be talking about any spin glasses today, but I will be talking about molecules at 1/10 filling. As far as what the equilibrium physics looks like, it's entirely possible it's glassy. But I've not looked at the...
If you're running the Hamiltonian, it'll be like random interactions in a way, right?
So it's not completely random, right? I mean, so... your J's are random, but they're not independent, for one thing. So, and they're not infinitely long range, and you know, I'm not sure how much their signs actually vary. So, you know, they're all pretty. It depends on the anisotropy in 2D. They're all the antiferromagnetic. So I don't know. I don't know about glassy physics to say for sure, but this is worth saying. So everything I'm going to talk about here is going to really focus on interesting things far from equilibrium that survive in these experiments. And in some ways, I mean survive this disorder. It's a separate and absolutely fascinating question to ask, what is the new physics that disorder can induce? And I'll just tell you one example of something I know about vaguely in this system, which is that if you think about a lattice and you fill it halfway, it's a square lattice, you know there's a percolation transition. So if I'm below this filling, there's no cluster that goes from one end to the other. If I'm above half filling, it goes from one end to the other. And so you actually see an interplay of some statistical mechanics and a phase transition of the underlying lattice with the physics that's going on in the lattice. And so I don't know what that does, but people have actually looked at this in classical statistical models. They've looked at exactly this problem. And so they see this multifractal behavior and the breakdown of self-averaging at this point. But I have no idea. Okay, yeah.
I have a quick question. So the experiment is we have one particle with 10 sites, and they're in a deep lattice. So what about the charge fluctuation? Is that small or large?
chart, you mean the hopping?
Yeah.
It's small. It's turned off.
Okay.
At the places we'll consider. Yeah, exactly. Also, you can get more interesting physics if you turn that tunneling on, but then you have to start thinking, do the reactions kill things? So for simplicity, so starting on the next slide, I'm really going to be like, what is the simplest thing we could do that gets past all these constraints? And so everyone is kind of, I was taking a picture of you guys there, and this is the reaction to the current constraints. What can we do that doesn't require this? So let's try to meet you in the middle. And I don't even know what this picture came from, but and I'll let you do any like psychological interpretation of these labels. But so experiments right now are hot and getting colder. And if you look at most or maybe all the other theory proposals, they're kind of at these cold temperatures and staying at these cold temperatures, and I've just drawn this arbitrary line separating them as 100 nanokelvin. And so today, I'm going to try to talk about how we can boost this, and we still may require cold temperatures, but at least we're starting to get some overlap with the experiments, and hopefully we can continue to increase this overlap. Okay, so finally the idea, if there are some people from the quantum control conference here, is to do highly suboptimal control. In other words, instead of doing some pulse shaping and things, we're just going to do what the experimentalists do every day and take a very simple pulse sequence of microwaves that couple the rotational states. And I'll talk about this. I mean, it may be suboptimal control, but our pulse sequences look a lot nicer than yours do. So the experimentalists would call this Ramsey spectroscopy. And let me just describe step by step what's going on when you do this. So initially, everything's in the ground rotational state. Now, I apply a microwave pulse with area theta. This rotates all the spins to an angle theta from the ground state. And so it will be very common to think about theta pi over 2, where they point in the x direction. And then they just turn this pulse off and they let it evolve for a time t. And during this time t, correlations may build up, entanglement may build up, and this is really where all the many-body physics is going to occur. And then this final pulse, in the language I want to use, is really just kind of a readout. It rotates your spin component around some angle theta prime so that you can read out the different components of your block vector. And so, if you want to look at Sx, you choose one value of this theta prime. If you look at S, if you want to look at Sy, you choose another value. And so this is very simple, and June and Debbie already do this. And in fact, the talk that Svetlana gave yesterday showed results looking at the magic angle using exactly this experiment. So this requires nothing new. And just as background, if you're a condensed matter theorist, you might see this is formally equivalent to a quench, what's called a quench. So you start in the state where everything's polarized. Now, that's the ground state if I just had a transverse field and no interactions. So it's like I'm starting initially from a transverse field model, and then I just turn the transverse field off so that all that's left is the Ising and the flip-flop interactions. And so it's like a drastic quench from between two phases. But I'm not going to talk about that at all here. Okay, so what can you do with this? We have this highly suboptimal control. What can we do with this? And so here's just a broad overview of what we predict you would measure, and then I'll get into why you would care about measuring this. So there are two parameters. One is the ratio J perp over JZ, which was the ratio of the flip-flop to the direct term. And this other axis is the filling. So one up here, these graphs are for unit filling, the dream, and these graphs down here are for one particle every 5 sites. And actually, to make the calculations easier, we did them in one dimension, and there, one particle every 5 sites is actually much worse than in higher dimensions because the guys are further away at this density.
Is it one particle every 5 sites on the average one?
On the average, and then we do a disorder average, and that's actually these error bars correspond to what you'd get after doing 100 realizations, but here each realization only has like 8 particles on average or something. So actually one experimental shot would have lower disorder error bars than what I'm showing here.
Do you accept
diagonalization? This is done, so these, all the calculations here, I believe, are done by Salvatore Monmana using time-dependent density matrix ring normalization group. And this is actually quite challenging because of two reasons. One, you have long-range interactions, and this makes DMRG much much tougher, especially if you do it in traditional ways. Two, we're doing dynamics, and this can be challenging if you go to long times. And three, we're doing disorder, which means you don't just run it once, but you have to run it for each disorder configuration. And because I refused to come up with a smart way to sample this for him, I just made him run, you know, many, many configurations. But he did it, and so it was a really impressive calculation.
How many configurations
do you typically? So for these results, it's actually 100 configurations. We have some more and less.
Two also technical questions. First, you have two curves in each, so.
Yeah.
But second, it's really, I mean, I'm very surprised that your error bars are so small.
Right.
How come? I mean, you have so, 1/r3 dependence there, right?
1/r3 dependence, so I'm not sure why. So you mean if they fluctuate strongly back and forth?
Yeah, exactly. It should be very. I mean, I would expect huge differences.
So let me come back to this as I explain the different curves, but hopefully it will become clear. The other question you might expect isn't even in the error bars. It's just why is the time scale for this the same as the time scale for this, roughly, right? So this is, the scales are different on these plots. I apologize. But this occurs around 5 in these units, and this occurs maybe at 3. Why is there less than a factor of 2 difference, even though it should be, you might think it would be 5 cubed. 125 times slower. And, well, so let me just answer that since I got there now. The reason is that what's happening is the rare configurations where two molecules just happen to sit next to each other are what dominate this fairly short time dynamics. And so what you'll notice is the time scale is the same, and that's also why the error bar is small, but notice the magnitude has gone down. So what you've sacrificed is signal strength. So you go from full half, this is, you know, spin 1/2, going between 0 and 1/2, to about 0.1 or so, and that's perhaps coincidentally a factor of 5, going from filling 1 to 0.2.
And you know that this is enough to be observed?
Yes, it absolutely is. It starts pushing the boundaries, but this is about where you can start seeing things.
So this spread is only due to placing molecules at different letter sizes, is not including uncertainty in atom numbers.
Right, so that's actually, I think, the biggest issue, the current uncertainty in the molecule number. On the other hand, things shouldn't depend sensitively on this. If you look at the dynamics for slightly different atom numbers, it'll change this F slightly and the total signal strength slightly. But so actually, I would say the error bars I've drawn are probably, for a rough idea, a good way to think about the current error you might see in experiments due to that. And I think that's the number one limiting factor.
It doesn't only depend on F, but actually probably the number of lattice sites and stuff like that.
Sure, yeah, because so the number of lattice sites will sort of, so this SX is really the SX per particle, the way it's normalized, so this gets multiplied by an N, plus the F gets changed, and those are the two things that change. But so there's an absolute scale that there's some disorder in. I'd be more worried about F changing because that changes both the sort of horizontal and the vertical axis a little bit, changes the shape.
So what is the blue curve?
Yeah, so the two different curves in each panel are just different initial tipping angles. And we'll see if I can remember what the tipping angles were. I believe that the purple curve, that like this lower curve here, I think that's pi over 2. So it's initially on SX. And then this one's either, I think it's pi over 4, but I'm not 100%, or maybe pi over, yeah, I don't know.
Now probably from the left axis, right?
Yeah, if I could do sine of theta in my head. Theta's small, you know, it's, we'll call it, yeah, I don't know. It's smaller theta, anyways. And so, you know, you could give a talk about the global behavior here. I'm not too interested in it for this talk, but you see some overall damping. You might call this a many-body decoherence. That's what it looks like experimentally. And there's some oscillations. And for large initial angles, the oscillations never cross through 0. For smaller angles, you see they actually oscillate around 0. And you can understand all of this behavior. But, yeah.
Maybe to follow up on Ida's question, so you tried only configurations where you have exactly enough 8 particles on 100 sites.
Yeah.
But would it really matter if you have on average 8 particles, but in some experiments you have 4, and some experiments you had 10? I don't think it would matter.
So it changes the numerics. This introduces additional error into your measurements.
No, but if most signal comes from, you know, particles that are in neighboring sites, I don't think that would change your signal.
But the number of particles that are going to happen to lie adjacent is going to fluctuate depending on your atom number.
Right.
Right? So it gives you a little bit of disorder.
Okay. So it'll increase your error bars, but the signal would be somehow the qualitative features would be.
Absolutely. And so we've actually done this. We've done this calculation.
Also, to rotate them, to rotate like 4 and 10 spins, you only need different travel frequencies, right?
So rotate.
No? No, it'll be just different pairs, so it doesn't matter.
So, I don't know what the question is. But so there is one difference. There's a factor of two difference, because when you have two particles in a cluster, you only have one neighbor instead of two neighbors, so it's kind of half as fast, and that's why this is a scale of 3 and this is more a scale of 6. But other than that, it's really the same. Yeah, we'll solve this question. I'll keep going. Paul.
Just one other question. Can you put your Hamiltonian back up again?
Sure.
Because I'm not used to thinking in terms of these formal symbols that people use. I just wondered.
This Hamiltonian?
Okay, that Hamiltonian, yeah. So I and J are your two sites, and they have some random distribution of what's on each site. Mm-hmm. S is basically a measure of the amount of mixing between the spin up, spin down.
SX would be.
In other words, J equals 0, J equals 1, J equals 0, equals 0, J equals 1.
Exactly. Yep.
And J, of course, is controlled by one of our cubed coupling between the two sites.
So this is the dipole.
The dipole coupling between the rotational energy transfer.
So each of these coefficients is proportional to a dipole matrix element squared.
Right.
Or a difference.
You can control the S's by your pulse, initial pulse, what you create.
You can control the initial S, yeah.
So you're setting the initial S. Mm-hmm. The J's are simply given by the intrinsic strength of the, you're not controlling that at all.
I mean, not in this proposal. You could, but yeah. Mm-hmm. There is an electric field. You need it to
split
these.
Split off the ones.
Right. And when I made this graph, I made different values of J perp over JZ. The different electric field allows you to tune the ratio of J perp to JZ. So a small electric field, you have a lot of J perp in the transition matrix, but very little JZ because you don't have a permanent dipole.
Okay.
When you go to big field.
When you apply the microwave.
What's the Rabi frequency?
So you compared to your
in the pulses, you mean?
1, 1, 0 there.
In the pulses? You mean in these pulse sequences? It's on resonant with 0, 0, and 1, 0
okay.
For a single ball.
But it's very small compared to that splitting.
The Rabi
yes,
frequency.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay, good. I just wanted to be sure.
I think Paul's asking the Rabi frequency.
The Rabi frequency for the 0 to 1 transition.
Oh, the Rabi frequency or the
initial pulse that sets your S populations.
So the strength of it depends. What matters is the pulse area.
Yes.
Right, so you apply however much it takes to rotate it by however much you want it. And this depends on really, so the Rabi frequency then depends on how short of a pulse you want. And the shorter you make it, the more intense you have to apply it.
Okay.
But the frequency that you apply the microwave is on resonant with 0, 0, and 1, 0.
Okay. I just wanted to be sure I understood your hand.
Yeah, that's great. Now my goofy slides get back up. Okay. So I think I've said more than enough about this slide. We have some understanding of the global behavior. Yeah, some things are persisting with disorder. And going back to Alexei's question, we have done calculations, in fact, where the initial particle number is allowed to fluctuate. We've done this averaging, and we do see it survive. So we've really checked that for small particle numbers, not for the number in experiment, but it's probably only going to get better as you have more and more particles.
Time scale here,
yeah.
So you
have to
care before the
milliseconds. 14 milliseconds. So for lithium cesium, that might be 14 microseconds. I don't know what it would be, but KRB, it's 14 milliseconds, and they have, so I didn't mention this yet, but they've measured in a 3D lattice of KRB, and at appropriate lattice depth, they get 25 second lifetimes. So in principle, we should see, 1,000 oscillations of these. And I'll get back to that at the end, because I don't really believe that statement. But.
One lattice?
So this is this calculation is for a 1D lattice. We've done calculations in special cases for 3D lattice. So this is a one-dimensional system with a one-dimensional lattice.
Does it have functional global
harmonic? Not here. We have actually checked using LDA, local density approximation, that this physics survives when you do the trap average. And we've also checked in special cases, you can actually solve it with inhomogeneous disorder, like you'd get in a real, and it survives there too. In the case
of that kind of oscillation, but this variable were on top, not to be so
bad. Not to be so what?
So the blue line on top.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there are only a couple of oscillations, no? But with a super close trap, I don't know if it could survive. There are only a couple of oscillations, so it's hard to say.
So at short times, it's very similar. Yeah, at long times, everything can get very different. But that short time is actually. So at zero, so if you're really at unit filling, the trap has absolutely no effect. Because what happens at zero temperature is you have a Fermi-Dirac distribution of these fermions. So I have one particle, one particle, one particle, one particle, one particle, and then zero, and my chemical potential drops. So the distribution of fermions in a trap, except for some very, very small wiggles at the edge, is going to be just one particle per site. But at these temperatures, it can be a big deal.
I have another question, which I just now figured that I don't understand. In your ideal case, this filling factor one, uh-huh. if you ramp up your J perp, your frequency. This is a different scale. Sorry, I was wondering why that gets low, but it's of course not the case.
Yeah, that's kind of protected. It turns out this is technically much more challenging, so we went to shorter times.
Yeah, this is
of course. That's 15, that's 6. Okay.
Sorry.
Yeah, Robert.
Can you explain where the damping comes from?
The damping? Yeah, sure. So let's just imagine the Eisen case where you can just actually exactly solve this. I'll show in a bit. When you have nearest neighbors, you have one frequency associated with that. If I have next nearest neighbor, that has a different frequency. If I have next nearest neighbor, that has a different frequency, 1/27. And so that already gives you not quite a continuum, but a dense set of frequencies. If I superpose those, I'm going to get damping. And actually, when you turn on J-perp, all those discrete frequencies spread out into a continuum. And so you have a continuum of frequencies, and you get damping.
Is it simple to say what the difference between the blue and the lavender curves are?
Yeah, so the lavender curves are initial states where you rotate to Sx, and the blue, you rotate about, I think, to pi over 10 instead of pi over 2. Mm-hmm. And it is pi over 10. I remembered now. So what can you do with this that a condensed matter person or a many-body physicist or anybody might care about? You can look at this dynamics. That's nice. It's a signature of dipole-dipole interactions. But can we go beyond this? And so forget about the equations. You can look at short times. You can do time-dependent perturbation theory. And you can analytically derive expressions for whatever lattice geometry, whatever filling you're at, and say, how fast do I expect this system to evolve? And for example, I can. Yeah.
So short time means you can make a series of
T. Exactly. Yeah. So it's actually. I do up to quadratic order, and it's really JZT or J-perp T is the dimensionless quantity.
The maximum
of those two is really what you're perturbing it. So you can get the coefficient of this T squared term for Sx, or it's linear in T for Sy, and you get this as a function of, say, your initial tipping angle, or J perp over Jz. You get all this dependence, and you see the formula is, this is for a 1D dipolar chain. You know, it's fine. You type it into Mathematica and it makes these plots. And here I've shown the plots for different fillings, and you see that there's this very characteristic structure, and you go, and if you measure this characteristic structure, you have a lot of confidence that you have, in fact, realized an XXZ model. It would be, you know, it would be a big coincidence if you got these curve shapes from just some other random model. So this is kind of a fingerprint of the XXZ model. You don't like this?
I don't understand.
Okay, so
what is that, what you're plotting here?
So this, what I'm plotting is the coefficient of this T squared term. Right. So at short times, going back to the previous slide, the evolution looks quadratic. And so that quadratic piece is coefficient, is what I call alpha. And here I'm plotting alpha, and forget about this. This is just, it's obviously going to get smaller if you decrease the filling. So I kind of normalize that out. And it also is you decrease Jz minus J-perp. If Jz is equal to J-perp, it's actually, this is an eigenstate and there's no evolution. So I also divide by this. So this is just rescaling to get these all kind of on the same scale. So as I change filling and Jz over J-perp, the scale will change. And I just didn't want to show that because it's even simpler than this structure.
And P is the filling.
Yeah, P is the filling.
Tell me again what theta means.
Theta is the initial spin angle. So it's, here are these two pulses. It's the first pulse. Exactly. And you can also imagine rotating in the other angle, phi, but everything's symmetric around phi for this model.
Okay, that goes through. And the question for alpha, there is no filling.
In this expression, I did it for p equal 1. Yeah, the expressions get longer for p equal. But that, I think that's, so this is one dimension, p equal 1.
And just another question about controlling JZ and JPERC. Is that done by a polarization angle?
It's done by just the electric field strength.
Electric field, mm-hmm. Okay.
You can do other types of control with the angle.
Electric field.
Exactly,
so
yeah.
Yeah, this weak electric field.
Yeah.
Okay, so it's, I got you.
It's not so weak. I
mean, it doesn't have to be.
If it's weak, then your J is strong enough.
Okay.
You said this is a fingerprint for the XXZ model.
Yeah.
Have you ever tried to change the carbon constant between XY and SZ?
No, I haven't. I should. That'd be a good check. But. Yeah, so I don't know what it looks like for, say, an XYZ model. And this would be an excellent check just to know how much this is telling you. Mm-hmm.
So as far as I understand, if you can experimentally determine it is alpha, you are kind of verifying that you have built the construct this XYZ model.
Exactly.
But is this many-body physics, or?
Well, this is, so if as a many-body physicist makes a proposal to do something, the first thing an experimentalist might want to do is make sure they're realizing it. So it's a tool for experimentalists to do many-body physics. This is time-dependent perturbation theory. You could have done this, as a second-year undergrad or whatever this is.
Maybe more questions a little. Collective effect, but is there correlation? Is
there? Yeah, there is actually. So if I looked at SXSX, so actually alpha in this case, if there were no correlations, alpha would be zero for a pi over two initial.
No correlation, and where does correlation come from?
From the dipole-dipole interaction. So if I initially have two guys like this, I can project it, for example, let's just do the Eisen case, I can project it on this. Plus this, plus this, plus this, right?
So think that you have just two dipoles.
Uh-huh. That's what I'm doing, yeah.
Yeah, just two dipoles. You don't have a sample of two dipoles,
right.
Just two.
Yeah.
You would still get exactly the same result.
No, you would not.
You would not?
Yep.
That's the thing that I'm not seeing. Where is the kind of the fact that you actually have a collection of spins and so on?
So I should say at this order in time there are no three-body correlations, but that doesn't mean that there's no difference between two and three molecules, right? So because if I have two neighbors, they'll both build up correlations with me, and this doesn't even have to work additively. But so it's really coming from that kind of thing. So, but you're right that there aren't like, it's not like there's a 40-body correlation function that's not zero here at short times. But, and actually I think you can show at each order in time or each two orders of time, you add a spin or two to the correlation function that becomes non-zero. So the first time that SXSX is non-zero is probably the quadratic order, SXSXSX would be sixth order.
Again, I think that this, in your Hamiltonian RIG, as being just the distance between two molecules.
That's it. Yeah.
This side, but I have this much, but I have another molecule that's going to be the same distance, and then can you add up all these contributions?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay.
I would guess this is a necessary necessary measurement, but not sufficient.
I mean, right. And then this is back to Xiaoping's question, I think, so how different would it look for an XYZ model? And I think this is a very good question that I don't know the answer to. It's a necessary condition, but I mean, if you got exactly the same curve from different models, you'd actually have to start thinking, wow, like what's going on here, right? So the question is, how different do other models look?
So can one actually do exactly analytically a calculation where you sort of write down these equations of motion and drop everything past the second order, past the two particle correlation? Can you then get an analytical formula? That would agree, of course, with that one to second order, but
yeah, that's like a self-consistent version of this. Yeah, I think so. I think actually, I haven't tried it, but I think you can do that. But if it wouldn't be analytic, it'd be easy to integrate numerically. And I bet you can do it.
Just one question about the way the scales with different molecules with different dipoles. Since you're doing it in JZ units, in a certain sense, if you had a different dipole, you might make things happen faster, but in these reduced units, it's still the same time.
And that's why I use the reduced units.
Really,
so I wouldn't,
you don't really gain a lot by going to bigger dipoles.
Well, no, you do, and let me show you where you gain. So it's right here. So in reduced units, nothing would change if I put lithium cesium on here. But for KRB, this point is 14 milliseconds. I put in lithium cesium, and it's 14 microseconds.
Okay, so maybe the time over which you can run an experiment,
exactly,
maybe maintain coherence.
And that gives you more time to do adiabatic manipulation. It means decoherence is less of an issue, maybe. So this is very important, and that's where it comes
from. Relative influence, possibly, of decohering terms.
Exactly, yeah. Okay, what about later times, and what are some more interesting things you can do? So someone asked, hey, is this many-body physics? And here's some real many-body physics, which I will not explain in too much detail, but I'll cite some papers that you can look up. So this is just SX. I showed the thing that's just a cosine. The blue curve is for nearest neighbors, just to contrast it with the dipolar interactions. This is in the Ising limit, so there's no J perp. And this is one dimension at filling one. And this is just for illustrative purposes. So there are special points in time, for example, right here, where you make something called a cluster state for the nearest neighbor case. And this cluster state is a universal resource for quantum computation. And what this is for, in particular, this means by doing only single qubit measurements in some classical computation, you can do an arbitrary quantum computation. Among other things, this means you can prepare an arbitrary quantum state by doing just measurements. So that's, in some sense, sort of the most useful state you could imagine, right? I mean, there's no state that's going to be able to do more in the sense, you know, maybe it does it more efficiently, maybe it's more robust, but in terms of what it can do, that's a pretty incredible state. And so those things were studied in this paper, and I think Briegel was here or is here still. Now in the alt-all case, what you get is not something quite so useful for quantum computation, but what you get is a Schrodinger cat state. At this time, you will get all the spins pointing to the right, plus all the spins pointing to the left.
So this is, in both cases, this kind of first minimum.
Yes, yeah. I mean, yeah. Uh-huh. And so, of course, neither of these are dipolar molecules. This is nearest neighbor and all to all, but I want to provide some backdrop that even though you're starting a completely uncorrelated state and you're doing dynamics,
and here you're actually using
an Ising Hamiltonian where everything commutes, it sounds very classical, not even quantum, you're getting these incredibly correlated, useful states. Okay, so
this is for filling equal one, right? I mean,
yeah. So I
would you get something interesting?
So here is filling not equal to one. So and this is also for dipole interactions. So let's. So in general, what you're going to get is squeezing. Okay, and so here I'm showing plots of decibels of squeezing. So that's minus 10 log base 10 of the squeezing, and I haven't defined squeezing, but give me a second. As a function of time. And this from time is from 0 to 1.5. And from top to bottom, the curves are, the top two are filling 1, the bottom two are filling 0.4. Okay? And then this curve is J perp equal 2, this is J perp equal 0, J perp equal 2, J perp equal 0. And so,
So your J perp is in the top slate, J perp is 0, right?
Yes.
And now you're...
Now this is more... I want to show that really, regardless of what you do to the system in terms of filling, J perp, you always get squeezing at these times.
And, yeah. So, yeah, this probably has some... So general means no matter all of these are squeeze states, that's what you basically say. So...
Well, I'm actually... The GHZ state isn't squeezed because there's a zero in the denominator or something you define, but it's a metrologically useful state that allows you to beat the standard quantum limit and go to Heisenberg limited metrology. And squeezing, let me define it this way, is the parameter that quantifies how well you can beat the standard quantum limit using a certain measurement procedure.
So, but here, your curves here are dipole-dipole.
This is all dipole-dipole. And this is also one dimension. Which is probably not optimal. So this is not a huge amount of squeezing, and this isn't going to get you much in terms of measurement accuracy. But it does tell you that at least in principle, even at these low fillings, you are getting some squeezing. It can help. And yeah, go ahead.
This is also for including this minimum state, right?
Yeah, so that occurs at some special time here, right? So assuming I didn't switch units here, this is right around minimum.
Yeah,
That actually looks a little fishy to me, so I would need to think for a second. I think I switched units, actually.
I have a question about the cluster state.
Yeah.
So the first minimum is a cluster state. Does this depend on the dimensionality?
I'm thinking, sorry, that's for two dimensions where it's the usual cluster state. Yeah.
Could you perhaps say it again? I misunderstood it. So you have the average SX over all sides, which is zero, right? It can be equal, it's like all left plus all right or something, but it can be also something.
And that's what happens in the GHC, it's all left plus all right.
But like it can be also something completely disordered, like just pointing in random directions, and also will give you SX over zero. So how do you create a GHC state?
Well, the way you create a GHZ state, and even if you read this paper, this is pretty much how it's defined. It says you evolve under an Ising interaction for this time, and you get a GHZ state. So you,
it's never disordered.
I don't know what you mean by disorder.
Like it's
translation.
Random directions. And, like, how do you know they are not pointing in random directions? It's all left plus all right.
So how do you know other than using the theory? How could you experimentally verify this? One way is you could do one-way quantum computation and see if you beat every supercomputer in the universe. Barring that, I don't know. So sort of witness for cluster-type properties. I talked to Manny Noh quite a bit about this, but I don't understand anything. Yeah, and I mean, so as a practical matter, this ignores decoherence, and as soon as I turn decoherence, GHC is going to be extremely fragile to this.
Okay.
I think cluster state's more robust, but in the closed Hamiltonian system, these are the states.
If you can disorder state, it will not care in principle, right?
If you do some sort of measurements, I mean, you should be able to look at the statistics and see if you get
So for the squeezing, this is experimentally measurable. And I will show you experiments on the ions that measure this, doing exactly what I've described here. And for the molecules, maybe we're even not so far away from doing that.
So perhaps you just said that when you answered Mr. Mitchell's question. But from what I remember from doing cluster states, the cluster state and the GHC state, they're not really that similar.
No, they're really not that similar, but they are both related in this way that they're both classes of graph states, which a graph state is just what happens when you evolve this on some graph which tells you how guys are connected. And when it's all to all connected, the graph state is a GHC state.
I mean,
when it's nearest neighbor, it's
obviously
cluster.
Obviously, both of that are SX equals zero state, right?
But yeah. I mean, so their properties are really extremely different. So they are subclasses of a much more general state, but they have no connection, really.
If you would do, and perhaps you cannot answer that, but let's say you wouldn't have 1/r^3, but let's say 1/r^6.
I've done this, yeah.
Would you also get the GHZ state?
So I could even show you So the GHZ state is for all-to-all coupling, not for 1/r³.
I see. So yeah. This is really... All the couplings are equally strong.
Exactly. These two are just really background. These are not dipolar molecules. The squeezing, this is dipolar molecules, and this is something that you can go experimentally measure just by looking at spin-spin correlation functions, but not even spatially. You just look at how much does my SX fluctuate from shot to shot and average that, and that tells you this.
And there's this question about going back to solution, measuring molecules and detectability. So that's basically measuring something about your J equals zero and J equals zero.
Right.
One.
It's population.
And that's, do they do that by converting things to ions and making a measurement?
So the way they do it typically is, I think they stir it back to atoms and then do absorption imaging.
So they do it that way.
They do have something that's kind of like, they do some transfer with, then do some cycling.
Do they only detect the J equals zero populations, or can they do one by flip them back to zeros and zeros up a stair back to the atom?
They can detect each. I'm not sure what states they flip through to do through them all, but they can detect them individually, to my knowledge. That's an excellent point. And going back to Aita's question, I think the total S measurements, so measuring the total S of the system, which is measuring the total population of the system, the noise on that, as well as in how many are actually there, is what's going to limit the accuracy of that. And it's so they're not at the shot noise limit where they're sensitive to one particle fluctuations. They're, I think their detection threshold is about 500 molecules.
And just one more question. Is June working on any kind of state imaging with state detection, or is that even going to be possible?
You mean local imaging? Yeah, local. Not single site, but they are improving. They're getting better CCD and doing I don't know what. But
they're looking at the whole sample.
So in one direction right now, they can see the cloud and how wide it is. In the other directions, it's like 2 pixels wide, but they're improving that, so it'll be maybe a 10 by 10 array. So you'll have some idea of what the shape is.
That's spatial resolution.
Spatial resolution.
They think they could do that state-specific, J0, J1, so yeah. And they will. Okay.
Excellent. Okay. Okay, so that's later times, and I said there's the squeezing, and I defined squeezing as being this metrologically useful thing. I also said it was related somehow to the correlations of the system. Let me just directly show you what the correlations look like. I should also say squeezing is an entanglement witness, which means if you see a squeezing, if it had a positive squeezing, which they all did for the values I show, then the state has to be entangled. And this holds even for mixed states, not just for pure states. So, but here's maybe a more elementary way of looking at it, which is just to look at the correlations, which says if I look at this spin, what do I know about some spin a distance I away? And so at initial time, you see there are no correlations, everything's black. So forget this plot for a second. And this is time on this axis. As time propagates, my neighbors start to know about my spin, then my next nearest neighbors, and you see the correlations spread out until all the atoms.
So how do you get correlations if I equals zero?
So a correlation function is this. So it's Sx squared at I equal to zero. Why that's time dependent a little bit. Oh, it's that's actually.
Well, yeah, because you put it into x and then it swings back, right? So.
Oh, but that's a constant. Sx squared is just one.
Yeah, Sx squared should just be all the natures. But I think.
Okay, so.
This is a very good question. I'm certain there's no nonsense going on because these are DMRG results that have been checked against an exact solution and against short time solutions. And so
you're going to send out the proofs?
Yeah, it's too late. It's too late. No, but I'm sure this is in fact has something to do with the. I don't know what has to do with.
Always blame it on the graphics packets.
I'm going to punt on that one. Ask me again in a couple hours, because that is very, very peculiar.
Maybe you subtract the.
Yes, he knows my results better than I do. This is, I'm not plotting this. I'm it's this minus SXA, SXA, and so the connected piece can change just because even though this doesn't change, the piece you're subtracting changes. Thank you. Much indebted to you. Maybe I should make you a co-author now or something. Okay, but anyways, you see correlation spreading and they're growing and it happens in sort of reasonable time scales here. And that's for filling of 0.4. And again, in 1D, where a filling of 0.4 is fairly low.
What are the zeta units again? Sorry,
what's what?
What are the units of
key? This is JZT.
The only thing that's a little strange on there is that little sharp line.
That's just a cutoff. I said when you pass a threshold, I draw it white. Oh, it's like the vertical cutoff in the plot.
Okay, so white basically means there's no more information there.
Yeah, it's huge.
And red means that it's a strong correlation, and green.
Yeah. So here's the scale.
Weaker.
Red is strong. Oh, black, green is weak.
Yeah.
And so that's for f equal 0.4. The correlations get to about 0.02. This might be hard to detect, but you know this. Maybe when June improves imaging, will be good. Here's f equal 0.1. And you see, at least in the structure of the correlation spreading, they're not so different. The scale of the correlations is a bit bigger when I have higher filling, which is probably not that surprising. One thing that surprised me is if I look at the correlations at long times in this dynamics, they're actually larger than the ground state correlations at long distances, which is what I plot in this guy up here. So if I just take the ground state of this model and I plot its correlation function, you see it turns black here out in the wings, and the dynamics, it's still nice and green. I don't understand why, but I think that's kind of cool.
that will be spread linearly.
Oh, sure.
And yet it looks quite constrained to 5 minus 5. It doesn't go beyond that.
So, yeah, I mean, if you plot out for longer times, you'll see that it does build up. But you're right. It's what's going on is actually there's an oscillation here. So you should probably think of it as a spreading superimposed with an oscillation. But it also does at long times. It does not spread as fast, and it probably is not linear. That's a very good point. Yeah.
I wonder whether you are interested in other measures of entanglement, such as concurrence for
So in
there are some very nice analytic approximations.
In a few slides, I could show you a lot about two-spin entanglement, negativity, discord, squeezing. So, but here the only actual entanglement measure that I've looked at has been the squeezing. So, but I haven't looked at concurrence or anything like this.
It's also kind of only of limited usefulness for many body states, as I learned a lot recently. So the concurrence is really a two particle entanglement measure. But here, what interests you is the entanglement that exists in the
world. It's also, to my knowledge, extremely difficult to calculate most entanglement measures once you go beyond two spins or three spins. I don't know about the
concurrence. Not only that, they don't really exist anymore.
Okay.
Do you have the understanding of this velocity? It sort of smells like this, you know, Lieb Robinson balance.
Yeah, here you actually beat Lieb Robinson because it's not a local interaction. You have 1 over r cubed.
Right.
But do if you did the nearest neighbor. What's that?
Do you have a formula and qualitative understanding of how fast that spreads?
I think Salvatore and I made a plot where it was basically zeta of 3 times j perp minus jz. So j perp minus jz is the scale, and the zeta of 3 is the sum of nearest neighbor, next nearest neighbor, next neighbor.
Can you derive that sort of? Do you understand why it is that?
That's like kind of a, I don't know, it's dimensional analysis or something, right? It's just, I imagine that every spin pulls on this spin, and then every spin pulls on this spin, and I don't know. So I think this works pretty well. We can talk more later. But I would say if you look at really long times, it actually spreads faster. Mm-hmm. And maybe you can even see that here, that it's maybe curving over a little bit from the platform. And even here, you can get some oscillations depending on what values of J-perp and J-Z you have. So you have to be careful what you're saying. It's a nice light cone. Cool. Okay. There's the overview. We have solutions and some limits. Here's graph versus theta, the initial tipping angle, and the filling. And we came to understand, actually, what happens at small theta is related to the short time stuff. So we understand that. What happens at j perp equals 0, as I'll tell you in a little bit, actually, we understand this very well. I'll tell you in 2 minutes. At this point, we also understand. It's interesting that the behavior in these regions of the phase diagram or phase space is really not tractable by any known theoretical techniques. So if you could explore that in an experiment, you're directly getting into regions that you might not know about. But so maybe I should just go ahead and wrap up because we are getting towards 3:00. Maybe I'll make one advertisement for a calculation somebody did, or maybe. Let me say one thing and make the connection to Svetlana's talk yesterday. So she showed this graph where the experimentalists took up the coherence time, and guess what tool they used to look at the coherence time? They did exactly this pulse sequence I described, the Ramsey spectroscopy, and they saw how fast does the signal decay, which is exactly these SX as a function of time plots that I've been making. And they even made graphs like this, which is SX as a function of time, which looks a lot like the kind of thing I've been plotting. Here it has to do with entirely one molecule physics. So it has to be when you're off the magic angle, you get these oscillations. And then this damping, they don't know where this damping comes from. And when you go to the magic angle, this time should diverge. You should, in fact, have an infinite lifetime at the single molecule level. So there are maybe two possibilities. One is that we're already seeing many body physics, and if I started looking at the curve shapes very closely at this magic angle that they've measured, that you'd see all the stuff I've been talking about. Now, I should say this was not done in a lattice, so there are some differences to what I just discussed, but it's pretty similar. Now, the more likely thing is that there's some technical thing going on that we don't understand, and I would love to figure out what this technical thing is, but but that's kind of ongoing. So the one thing I wanted to advertise was dealing with this.
So one question, and that somehow came up yesterday, and you mentioned that before in one of your... So what you call many-body mapping, I think that's the word you use. So what exactly is that?
So all I mean is when I made these global pictures of the dynamics and oscillated and it damped, well, that looks just like decoherence, right, that damping. And so that's what I was calling the many-body damping. So kind of everything I've talked about.
Also, just because of the spread of frequencies. Exactly.
Just any interaction, basically, with you would call many-body.
Yeah.
So the experimental data that there are these dots, right?
Yes.
And the red line is just a Lorentzian fit.
Yes.
That's yeah. 1.5.
It's not exactly even a fit. I mean, there's an understanding once you know how far you are from the magic angle from Svetlana's theory, you can actually say what do you expect the decoherence to be in.
Yeah, but if it's
yeah.
1.5 or goes higher, probably you cannot resolve
what you say. Well, I mean, they've...
If it's sufficiently narrow...
What's that? That's a good point. So, that's another way of saying it's an experimental imperfection. Maybe they can't tune the angle well enough.
So what you say, they should just measure a couple of more points.
I mean, for what it's worth, I can tell you they've measured many more points around here and they never see it go up.
Exactly, 2 points close to the maximum.
Yeah.
Because from the other, you cannot check, unless you are able to give a measure of the width of the peak.
Well, I mean, yes, so I agree. But in some sense, that's what I mean. So that's an experimental imperfection. How well can you control this?
The error bar on the x-axis.
Yeah.
Which could be smaller than the dot.
I think actually it is smaller than the dot, except for an absolute shift. But that still doesn't mean that you don't have to look, you know, at a million points in here to see that. Yeah. Yes.
I mean, you wonder that there are yeah. problems of polarization of laser. I mean, there can be kind of things that will happen.
Well, you said this was a three-dimensional gas rather than a lattice, so it's a gas experiment, and I don't know all the details of the experiment, but there's an electric field there. Collision rate goes dramatically up in the electric field.
So right. So
there, what about the collision coherence effects?
So here there is
not a source of explanation.
So here, look at the time scales. It's a couple milliseconds, so the collisions aren't so important on that time scale. Plus, they're not an electric field. I think they use a magnetic field to polarize the slightly align the molecules, but really it's yeah. So it's different in that in the lattice and the fact they're using magnetic field. But I don't think collisions are too important here.
And they've even measured
the populations and don't see much decay on scale. Yeah.
Do you discuss some universe
of
point you could it's not possible?
So as a function of what? What do you mean?
The function of it looks like a divergent field. And
that
could be fine,
deviation from the so at the single particle level, I believe it would just be 1 divided by the angle minus the critical angle, 54 degrees, or shifted to 51 degrees. I think that's the power law you'd get. But that's single, really single particle physics, just from a time scale scaling, kind of, you know, so the time scale scales with the angle. So in energy splitting scales linearly with the angle, so the time scale scales like the inverse of that.
At many particle level, it wouldn't diverge.
At the many particle level, it will saturate.
Do you need to impute magnetic field in your system?
Well, you don't have to, but I think it would be awesome to figure out what we can do with the magnetic fields.
If you will do it, then it should be also perpendicular to polarization.
So I think it depends what you want to do. I mean, maybe you have some comments, or actually maybe Michael also has some comments on this. Well, no, but it has yeah. So it has nuclear quadrupole coupling, right? And this is actually sizable.
I don't even know how. So the way they do this experiment is they pick one of these excited states. I don't know which one.
I think this graph is 1-0. They've done 1-1 and 1-1.
Which
and then they pick the hyperfine state. You mean
hyperfine state, right?
Yeah, so I don't know which one they choose.
By what
yeah.
Saying, so.
Yeah. So I do know they actually went to great lengths to make sure they could assign these different hyperfine states at some point. And so, but I don't know the details for this.
These are fermions. So if you make a clock state mixture, then presumably identical fermions, so we have the low rates. They did find in their unpublished work of a few years ago that if you made an incoherent mixture of J1 and J0, the J1 plus J0 collision rate was well above the S-wave unitarity limit. So essentially, it's a very long-range dipole-enhanced, more than S partial wave type collision. So it's very, very fast. Yeah. Happened on a millisecond timescale.
Yeah.
So they have non-decohered fermions.
Well, so at least in the initial state here, everything's coherent.
Yeah,
it decoheres.
As soon as it begins to decohere, those bad collisions come in very, very quickly.
Yeah. So people are poking in. Let me just throw up one last slide, and then I just want to say one thing. So we actually have for the Ising limit an exact solution that includes all kinds of decoherence, and this is just, you know, so I think it was Bretislav said that exact solutions are a rare, precious jewel, and here this is, to my knowledge, the only exact solution of a many-body system with decoherence. So wonderful. Okay. And so we've compared with ion experiments. You see very good agreement between experiment and theory, including the decoherence. And that's for the SX depolarization. We're in the process of looking at squeezing and anti-squeezing. And so, okay, that's all. Thank you, guys.